This is Building Bridges with Ken Nash and Mimi Rosenberg. Detroit has cut water service to thousands who can't afford to pay. And we're joined by?
We're joined by D'Amico Williams from the Detroit Water Brigade and Tom Stevens with Detroiters Resisting Emergency Management.
I want to start with the resistance, if you will. This is everybody's fight. Water is a human right. That's the chant the protesters used in recent weeks. Activists in Detroit who have mobilized against the city's efforts to cut off the water supply to 120,000 delinquent accounts or over 300,000 city residents. What? Cutting water to poor folks? Who wants to begin?
From Occupy Detroit, this is Tom Stevens.
Tom, please, take it away.
You said it. You know, I mean, all this time, Governor Rick Snyder and his emergency manager, Kevin Orr, and his bankruptcy firm, Jones Day, the largest law firm in the country, have been saying that they're going to save Detroit. You know, and now we find out, as we see how they're handling the water department that serves this whole region of 4 million people, this whole water-blessed region, that they intend to save Detroit by destroying it. This is a savage austerity program that's being implemented through emergency management and bankruptcy, and it has now reached the point where they have so completely dehumanized Detroiters that they say, well, you're a couple months behind your water bill, you're poor, tough. There's some punishment for you, some collective punishment, as Representative Conyers called it the other day. It's really unbelievable that it came to this, but it is also opening a lot of people's eyes as to what the government is doing to us.
D'Amico, I know that there was a press conference today in protest. If you could tell us a bit about that and also other actions that the Detroit Water Brigade is active in.
Yes, peace and greetings to all of you guys. Yes, we had a press conference with Congressman John Conyers today. It was a call to action for all parties, which is, residents, citizens, and people around the country to start getting involved in the water crisis because the needs are dire. And it is a very unfortunate situation where people are trapped with no exception, no regards, or even any type of remedy to solve the problems that we are faced with. The assistance programs have gotten a little bit low to nothing at all. And also, the Detroit Water Brigade is a rapid relief response crew made up of volunteers, of friends, family, and those that care about what's going on in the water crisis. And we deliver water to families that have been shut off in the Detroit water crisis. We serviced about 75 families. We donated about 8,000 bottles of water. We just got another case of 48 pallet case of water this morning. So, you know, as they roll in, we're continue working. And John Conyers addressed the need that the president and everyone else needs to get involved.
I must admit, the last time I remember water brigades were when I was in Coney Island after Hurricane Sandy, when people were trapped in public housing projects on the 14th floor, etc. And that was a unique situation, was, as I was indicating, when people were trapped without electricity, without working elevators, of course, and so on the 14th floor of their housing projects immediately after Hurricane Sandy. This is a situation analogous to the most drastic, almost warlike situation. So this is extraordinary. I'm still aghast at what a situation like this portends. It's absolutely extraordinary. And one of the things that I should say, it's my understanding that in the past 10 years, Detroit residents have seen water rates rise by 119%. So what's really going on here?
There is also a plan where the emergency manager is trying to he's trying to privatize the system while jack up the rates on everyone else. I mean, that's why they did it to Detroit, and it's just a very unfortunate situation. You know, some people can't even pay their bills while they're on the payment plan because the water department is not considering, you know, there's also need to be a water bill analysis, because I've heard some residents tell me on the Canvas Trail that they feel that they have been cheated out of their bills, and they even use that much water or sewage, and it's more in the sewage than it is in the water. So there has to be an investigation onto the water board. I call for one around these bills, because it's becoming a hot-button topic in the city of Detroit.
Tom
can speak to some more on that.
Tom, and also people are being cut off after owing only $150. Is this the only way to go?
Yeah. You know, our one of our partners, you know, Michigan Welfare Rights, years ago, together with Michigan Legal Services and other poverty lawyers here in Michigan, had retained an expert, Roger Colton, and he had proposed a water affordability plan, which is doing a fee structure based on the ability to pay. And, you know, it's the kind of thing that's done if you really care about being a utility that provides, you know, this necessity of life on an equitable basis, instead of this kind of crazy stuff of sending contractors out all over the city, terrorizing everybody, cutting off thousands of families a week. And there was a big political struggle between 2005, 2006 over the water affordability plan that Michigan Welfare Rights Organization proposed. Since a lot of people were being cut off then, too, not as many per week, but, you know, like tens of thousands a year, they were eventually able to persuade the Detroit Water and Sewerage Department to adopt their version of what they called the Detroit Residential Water Affordability Plan, which was basically just setting aside money. I think it was in the form of interest owed on overdue accounts, so that if people got in trouble and they were in shutoff status and they called in and made an arrangement and kept their side of the bargain, there would be some money available to help pay the arrears. So that at least there was something there, you know, not like this fiasco we're facing now. But, I mean, these days, the Detroit Water and Sewerage Department and the emergency manager spokesman are still saying, oh, there's programs, call us, work with us. It's complete nonsense. There's no money available. If you look at the op-ed that Anna Clark wrote in the New York Times on July 4th, she caught them red-handed that they were saying publicly that there was going to be a new pot of money available to help these people catch up as of July 1st, and it's totally not available. Now they're saying maybe by August 1st.
Well, it's quite extraordinary that we need the United Nations to come in here, although why not, and issue a statement, which they did last week, that the city's plan constitutes a violation of the human right to water. So from my own perspective, payment or no payment, it's a human right. It's fundamental to the existence of the human condition. So within that, what is being done in response to this? And then I still want to dig deeper and drill on down to what is really going on in Detroit with such drastic moves. Is it all about privatization? Where are we really at, Tom?
Yeah, that's exactly what it's about. I mean, and austerity. I mean, what's going on right now is that there is an active mediation under some district court judges, U.S. federal district court judges in Detroit, ordered by the bankruptcy judge to try to put the Water and Sewerage Department under a new regional leadership. The suburban county leaders don't want any part of it. They're happy to sign off on some kind of a deal that where some corporation comes in, takes it over and privatizes it, but they don't want to be responsible for running this system. This is a system that involves billions and billions of dollars, and you know they want it all favoring, you know, their companies doing the work, their people getting the subsidy on the on the service, which is what it's been doing, and you know the fact that the emergency manager and the department are now putting the burden of, you know, increasing the value of the asset by cutting off the bad debt on the poorest people in Detroit tells you all you need to know. And it really does exemplify, you know, what emergency management is all about. Detroit is 139 square miles of cheap urban real estate on one of the busiest international border crossings in North America, in the middle of one of the best collections of freshwater resources in the world, the best. And relatively sheltered from things like earthquakes, hurricanes. We don't have that stuff. We have tornadoes now and then. So there is a tremendous prize here if you can just get rid of these pesky poor people that live here.
There was a number that you had in one of the articles that you wrote that the shortfall in the deficit was only $198 million a year for Detroit. It seems as if this whole bankruptcy is blown up out of all proportion. What do you think?
Yeah, that's absolutely true. I mean, $198 million is still a lot of money. And there's no question that the city of Detroit, as it is currently structured with the cutbacks in state revenue sharing, with the spatial racism that exists where the jobs are out there and the people are in here, with the decades of disinvestment and white flight and deindustrialization and middle class flight and capital flight, there's no question that the city of Detroit is in a serious economic crunch, as is the rest of the world, just Detroit more so. But yeah, the bankruptcy, and in particular, remember the emergency manager, and making the emergency manager not only him, but his law firm.
That's manager Kevin Orr.
Right. And mm-hmm. Jones Day, his law firm. Mm-hmm. And you, I mean, this firm represents major creditors of the city of Detroit, like Bank of America and UBS, these major Wall Street interests. So there's conflicts of interest all over the place. This one company basically has all the powers of local government, its local council, and the state's powers, which put them there.
D'Amico?
Yes, I would like to say that everything Tom Stevens is right on. We've been keeping a death toll, a financial death toll of the city of Detroit, of money that it could have spent on, you know, restructuring. It could have spent on, you know, jobs, education, and opportunity. It also could have been spent on the buses. It could have been spent on the streetlights. And it could have been spent on, you know, most definitely keeping the water utility running. Well, the city has spent over $75 million on this bankruptcy. I mean, this is it's crazy. Then I perceived it after I did the initial math, you know, of how much people are getting bonuses and fees to these consultants and lawyers and people. It's $750 million. That's the money Rick Snyder owes the city of Detroit in the revenue sharing. I also would like to add that the city is suffering. It's not getting any better. The decisions being made in the bankruptcy court are not favoring the city. Mike Ilitch is a local billionaire here in the city of Detroit. He owns the Red Wings. He owns Comerica Park and the Joe Louis Arena. And both of those places are in debt of their water bills. Comerica Park owes, I believe, $55,000 to $60,000.
It's kind of fascinating. I hadn't even thought about that.
Bills.
The Detroit
but,
Red
I mean,
Wings.
This is all about getting away with, you know, it's corporate greed. I mean, corporations are not people. They shouldn't be treated as such. And I think that
we'll have to tell the Supreme Court that.
Wrong,
but, yeah.
And it'll do it to other cities.
So the resistance. Where do you go from here, both of you, in terms of there's obviously the people themselves? And you know what I want you to do first? Paint a picture of somebody's life living without water, which I find incomprehensible. Put a human face on this. D'Amico?
Yes. I would like to bring up the story of Nicole Hill. She was on the NBC Evening News last night, and when I pulled up on the scene, she was already talking to the cameras. They'd been in her home. When you go into the house, there's a bad stench in the air when you get into the kitchen. Her floors are sticky. She has dishes in there from the past 2-3 weeks that have not been cleaned. The refrigerator is going bad. And she had to send her children away to her aunts, you know, until she can find, you know, a better solution. Nicole Hill has about $5,000 in her bills. She go to school full time. She was working at a job, and she got cut in the winter. And her life has spiraled out of control financially. She has tried every possible means to go through assistance programs to the state DHS program. There is no help available. She has tried to go through other organizations and even tried to hit up her church and her family. There is no help available. And she's been trying. She's been living without water for the past 6 or 7 weeks. When I saw her story on an email listserv, I had to reach out to her to see if she was all right. I just made contact with a doctor that will offer free services to people who have their water shut off to check the elderly and the children. And Mrs. Nicole Hill, basically, you know, she got, like, help today. We were told at 12 o'clock that the water affordability plan was back reinstated again. I'm not sure on the details of that, but there was a reach out for Mrs. Hill to get on the program. as far as other people that are living without water for a year, I go in canvassing for the past 2 weeks, and I'm coming into contact with people who are afraid to tell about their situation because of the scorn and the shame that they get from the social media world that we live in today. They've been living without water and lights for a year, ever since the polar vortex of the winter. And we ask people, you know, how have you been surviving? Some have had to get their water hose, transfer a water hose through the window. Some have had to fill up on jugs, had to boil water. There's even some people that are living, you know, just surviving for the hell of it. You know, this is the only way. It's like a jungle out here in the streets of Detroit. I don't think nobody really knows about struggle.
Mm. Tom?
It's real.
Well, that's a heck of a picture. That's a heck of a picture. We can begin to internalize that. So what does the rest of the nation do? What are Detroiters doing to resist and to fight back? There's the obvious service component and the philanthropic effort, but on a broader scale, what needs to be done?
Well, I think there's a whole bunch of mobilization, public education, pushback on every level. It's very difficult because you're talking about a community, it's beyond David and Goliath. You know, you're talking about a community that's been deprived of resources systematically to put it in this position. You're talking about, with emergency management, a policy, a statute that really has no precedent. And then you have in Detroit, with all of Detroit's unique challenges, you have this giant law firm and its partner acting as the governor's agent to implement this kind of restructuring, which is nothing good for anybody that lives here unless they're on the payroll. So it's a process of staying on top of that and doing as much education as possible. And, you know, it's hard to say where it's going because in the last 6 weeks or so since the water shutoffs started, seriously, the whole situation has really transformed. You now have a lot more understanding. You have a lot more public disclosure and discussion and admission that, yeah, this isn't really a good thing. Where it goes next, you know, they're in the process of getting the bankruptcy case wrapped up, they hope, by the fall. Part of that is going to be saying, okay, well, now you've got a whole new restructured operation for your government, and it's supposed to be a great thing. Yeah, I'll believe that when I see it from these guys that are running around shutting off families by the thousand from water.
I think we should all be in Washington demanding, you know, there was a bailout of, there's always a bailout of the corporations and so.
I think Detroit, if they started to tax the banks there and tax the rich and focus more on that rather than trying to cut off water to the poor. What do you think about that, Tom? We just have a minute left.
We need a just economy. We need a green economy. We need to deal with our energy needs and our water needs and our human needs and education and all the human needs, put them first and reorganize and deal with those things. What we see now with the restructuring of Detroit through emergency management, bankruptcy, and these water shutoffs is that the powers that are in charge are going the opposite way. They're just continuing to try to exploit people and abuse people as long as they can get away with it. It's our job to fight that.
Well, I would concur with Ken, certainly, and I would still demand that the federal government step up to the plate in terms of the overall bankruptcy of Detroit. And we hear you loud and clear, Tom, and a heroic effort on the part of the people here. And as I said, the United Nations needs to come in and say that this constitutes a violation of the human rights to water. Well, we all have to say that, and we have to really step up to the plate for our sisters and brothers in Detroit. Happens there, it can very well happen here. This cannot be allowed to stand. And if people want to get in touch with you and they want to figure out how to join with the Detroit Water Brigade or Detroiters Resisting Emergency Management, Tom, what do we do? And
you can Google those websites or also the Detroit Water Brigade, Detroiters Resisting Emergency Management, People's Water Board Detroit, and Detroit Water Brigade are the sites, and they're very active these days.
And a lot of good information on it.
D'Amico?
Yes, and also you can go to the DetroitWaterBrigade.org. We have comprehensive information. There's also, you can open up a resource hub or a neighbor hub in this, if you live in the city of Detroit. If you're outside in America, you can donate to the page. Also, you can look for me on Facebook if you need more information. Miko A. Williams on Facebook.
This is Everybody's Fight. Water is a human right. Special thanks to D'Amico Williams and Tom Stevens. We've got to rise to the occasion.
One of the postings on the website of Detroiters Resisting Emergency Management is the five-part video, Scenes from an Endless Dinner in Detroit, by Kate Levy. She provides background and analysis of Detroit's bankruptcy crisis by presenting misconceptions about Detroit and the logic some activists bring to the table. We present part one now, and you can watch all five episodes online at www.d-rem.org.
A dichotomy in national media's attitude towards Detroit. They either highlight the despair of a city in bankruptcy, or they describe Detroit as a city of opportunities, a frontier for a growing creative class. These stories, whether positive or negative, share one thing: historical amnesia. In a city that's 80% black, these stories ignore the racially charged history of urban renewal. They overlook Detroit's bitter history of white flight and racial segregation. And they turn a blind eye to the fact that the people in the institutions profiting off of Detroit's troubles may well have created them. And we'll get to this later, but one individual, Dan Gilbert, has been buying up a staggering number of properties downtown at record low prices and is being revered as Detroit's new superhero. Gilbert has paid for a campaign called Opportunity Detroit. The slogan can be seen everywhere, from buses to rehabilitated buildings. Its main objective is to attract new residents to the city. And just one more thing before we begin. Just prior to Detroit's filing of Chapter 9 bankruptcy, Michigan Governor Rick Snyder appointed a non-elected emergency manager. This guy has the power to overrule any decisions made by the city's elected government. My father and I discuss these issues every time we sit down for dinner, at length. Most of the time I'm lost for words. I just wish I could figure out a way to convince him that his views are misinformed.
My father used to bring me here. Well, anyway, I was trying. I think you're here at a very interesting time, and I think that for you to capture what's going on in the city, there's a lot more positive than people are giving it credit for. I mean, I think if you do it right, and you're here to tell a story of rejuvenation, all people hear is bankruptcy, and they go running. I mean, not of course not candy coating it. Nobody expects anybody to lose their objectivity, but if you're really on a positive instead of a negative kind of a bent.
Welcome to my loft. This entire block of buildings that's all startup focused. We've got five buildings in the same block that 2 years ago were all empty. Moose Jaw, City Loft, it's not like a suburban shopping experience. We're in an urban shopping experience.
Downtown does not trickle down. For the last 50 years, cities have put nearly all of their eggs in the downtown redevelopment basket.
This down here is special.
It's a very wonderful small town, basically. I mean, this feels like a village to me.
No, we got Grosse Pointe right on up the road, and I cannot go to any of the parks that face off on the river down there or the lake, because all of those parks, you have to have a citizenship in that community to be able to use them. And yet, the folks from Grosse Pointe have been able for years and years to come.
For more than 2 years, Red Book had been working with merchant associations in shopping centers, studying young adults.
There's 800,000 people that already live here.
Yeah, okay. Sweetheart, look at the city. Do you think you could possibly give developers too much power? You have to get them to put their money into this town and hope like hell people want to come and live in it and buy.
City of Detroit's relied heavily on tax abatements from the city budget to entice companies to move their businesses downtown. To obtain a tax break, one must work with the Detroit Economic Growth Corporation, a quasi-private nonprofit consulting agency. These confusing city-sanctioned agencies are not uncommon in municipalities across the U.S. and were first mandated through public acts in the 1970s. It's only through the DEGC that a business may approach city council. City council votes to approve the tax credit. Still, the emergency manager has final say over whether the company receives a tax break or any other financial incentive for that matter.
When you have all of these freebies, these giveaways, it undercuts the revenue that's coming into a city. You are looking at a situation where they may be given 10, 15 years not to have to pay taxes. People do not have jobs. And then you want to give them a job that pays them $7 an hour instead of a job that where they could be properly trained and earn a good, decent living wage.
I don't know that I can point to that many areas that got, you know, tax breaks and what have you that I would now look at and say, wow, this is a great thriving community.
Marathon Refinery received $175 million in 2007 in tax break. They only gave Detroiters 15 jobs. 15. And when Councilwoman Brenda Jones asked Marathon execs about this blatant disregard, I watched that city council meeting. These executives just blew her off. And by the way, the zip code that the refinery that got the tax breaks is in, 48217. It's the most polluted zip code in the state.
There's sort of been this mentality that we're so desperate for development that we're going to take anything. Progress is seemingly always defined as creating situations where folks with more money can somehow benefit from the city.
Detroit's services challenge is because we got multi-billionaires who were subsidizing and they're not contributing. They're not.
Well, this has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg
and Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.